This session is on imperialism today, and specifically with respect to China, the United States, and Australia. The speaker, who is Emma Norton, and I'm not making this up, an astrophysicist, historian, and member of the Maritime Union of Australia, and a member of Socialist Alternative here in Sydney. Emma's going to speak on the topic for some time. We can have discussion afterwards. If you haven't been at the previous sessions, we can have a chance for everyone to ask questions or make their contributions from the floor afterwards. This is part of the Introductions to Marxism stream at the conference. So in particular, if you're new to socialist or Marxist analysis of imperialism, geopolitics, warfare, and so on, please do ask your questions. Make sure you get it out so we can have a chance to discuss it together. But for now, I'll let Emma introduce the talk.
Okay, cool. Well, sadly for humanity, there has not been a single day in the last century where the whole world was at peace. Every single day in the last century, and actually every single day since the beginning of capitalism, there has been somewhere, someone fighting a war. And I think as well, we now stand on the brink of a potentially even more devastating war than the world has already seen. America, China, Russia, a whole series of countries around the world have nuclear weapons, and America has demonstrated its capacity to use them already once in world history. World military spending has actually been on the increase over the past 2 years and now stands at $1.7 trillion yearly across the world. And the US, as we know, leads the way and accounts for 37% of global arms spending. But in recent years, China in particular is racing to catch up with the US's war chest. And has seen a huge growth in their military spending. Alongside American encouragement as well, big spending increases have occurred across Asia and the Middle East. The last century as well has witnessed the most devastating wars of human history. Advanced weaponry and expansive armed forces made up of skilled and disciplined soldiers have allowed nations to wreak havoc on each other's militaries and civilian populations. The world was shocked by the brutality of World War I, the first war to pit Europe's vast armies against each other using aerial bombardment, tanks, artillery, and trench warfare. Supposedly enlightened Europe dragged the entire world into its bloodiest battle up until that point and killed 18 million people and wounded 23 million more. World War II was even more devastating still. It was the biggest catastrophe in human history. The death toll from aerial bombardment of concentrated civilian populations, extended occupations, and the use of nuclear weapons, and of course, ethnic cleansing carried out by the Nazis, was up to 80 million people. And since then, again, we have seen wars rage across the world. And socialists have always sought to understand why it is that modern society is so prone to violent destruction and war. And like I said, it's not merely a historical question for us. I think many people in this room should be concerned, if they're not already, at the potential for a war between America and China that would drag the rest of the world into it as well. And so the point of this talk is to introduce people to the Marxist concept of imperialism and demonstrate how it can explain this tendency in the world towards war and rampant nationalism. And I'll point as well to the bitter resistance to war that periodically emerges among those who have to fight them and those who suffer at home from the deprivations associated with war. And I think how socialists should position themselves on a series of questions. I was saying to someone before, it's not as simple as just saying, yes, we hate war, we're against it, it's terrible. There are a whole series of political questions that come out from all of these questions that I'll try and go over a little bit. So, there are some standard explanations for why war happens. The first is kind of just general racist slash nationalist crap about the defence of the nation against supposedly backwards or tyrannical regimes, against, you know, uncivilised people. And this has always been part of the justification used by ruling classes for the wars that they wage. So in World War I and World War II, the Germans and the Japanese to the West were presented as horrific villains. And I think often straight up racism is used, in these justifications. And for left wing people, it can't be sufficient to blame just the other side in these conflicts that appear so often, and in which the enlightened West is just as likely to commit horrific atrocities. And I think the recent experience of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have aptly demonstrated just how horrific the West, you know, and America in particular, can be when they invade these countries. Nor is it the case, obviously, that America or other Western countries are these splendid democracies where, you know, equality and democracy reign. So this is not a satisfactory explanation. The other explanation that can seem a little bit more tenable is, and is quite popular in progressive and liberal circles, is that wars are simply the result of crazy warmongers like Nixon or Bush or Trump. The narrative goes that if crazies like Trump find themselves at the helm of the nation, then we're all in trouble. But with adequate negotiation, diplomacy, a nice liberal figure like Obama, perhaps, at the head of the nation state, working together with other countries and so on, then wars can be avoided. I think, again, this doesn't explain the actual history of capitalism. The various wars that have begun under the patronage of more supposedly acceptable leaders, the fact that Obama himself continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for a period, or the fact that usually all of these wars have bipartisan support across political parties and across the kind of members of the capitalist class and ruling class. You know, the Democrats in America are a perfect example for this. There's no war that they have not supported, even if they were not the people, in government carrying it out. The other thing that is, again, a little bit more right, but still not quite the full picture, is a popular idea on the left that wars break out simply to grab a country's resources and steal them and take them away. And so this is often presented as the reason for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that it was simply a war about grabbing oil. Now, obviously, there is, like, the fact that Iraq is oil rich was a very important part of the equation in America going to war in that country. But I think it's incapable of explaining some other examples, like Afghanistan, which has virtually no resources to speak of that anyone would want. Vietnam as well. This was not about grabbing resources in that case. And I think similarly, it doesn't explain the fact that America could have literally bought every single last barrel of oil in Iraq for less money than they spent on the arms and the soldiers that they sent to Iraq in that war. So clearly, nations go to war for something a bit less tangible than just pure raw materials. And I think the thing that they really go to war for is power and dominance on the world scale. So I think conventional explanations for war don't really take us very far. And Marxists instead use the concept of imperialism and put that at the centre of our analysis. So imperialism is the constant battle between nations for power in a global capitalist market. And I think it flows naturally from capitalist competition. It's an inherent part of the world that we live in, of the capitalist world. And this is true on a smaller scale when you think about it. Capitalists have to compete. They're a band of warring brothers that battle across various markets. So they have to battle for where they can sell their products, where they can buy their materials, what groups of workers they can purchase the labour power of, and so on. They fight as well over who gets to control various resources, so which companies will have the contract to extract oil here or there or whatever. And blocks of capitalists tend to band together to defend their collective interests against blocks of other capitalists. They draw borders which define their influence. They control the working populations within that area with a military and police force and a set of national laws. And so the vehicle for this whole struggle, which is an outgrowth of the general competition between capitalists, is the nation state. I think it's worth saying that capitalism has never been able to exist separate from the state and its violent apparatus. The state, by which I mean the government, the armed forces, the police, the laws and stuff, has always been necessary, both to create the very conditions in which capitalists can make profits, so a pliable, skilled labour force, for example, the enforcement of rules of engagement between the capitalists themselves. And it's also, the nation state has also served the very important purpose of allowing capitalists to defend their interests against rival blocs of capitalists. In the first instance, the ability to exploit the masses of people has always been enforced by the state. So you think slavery and colonialism was a way of creating vast labour forces. All of that was created by the British state in the first instance. And today you only have to look at the operation of Australia's industrial laws, like the Fair Work Laws, that effectively ban the right to strike, or China's very similar way of, much worse obviously, but way of suppressing independent trade unions and creating whole new labour forces, to see how important those national states are in maintaining capitalism. And outside their borders, the ability of big capitalist enterprises to access global markets in a race against rival blocs has also always been enforced by their nation state. So you think of how the colonial empires of Europe were built with the swords and muskets of their states' armies. often in direct conflict with each other, as well as the native populations which they brutalised. And think as well of how the US more recently has used its military to expand its control, its economic control over Central and Latin America, where it's opened up those economies to US companies and the global market. When it's suited them, they've put in place US-friendly regimes through either straight-up ground invasion or subverting democracy from within. So people probably know about various CIA-backed coups that have occurred and so on. So the competition between capitalists therefore becomes more sophisticated and broadens to the world stage. It becomes the struggle between nation states. And in many cases, this means a struggle between kind of alliance systems of alliances between those states themselves. So you think of the Cold War and the kind of East versus West alliances that lined up against each other. And if you've ever played Risk or Diplomacy, that's how I often kind of think of how these decisions get made, because it is cold calculations about power in the world. You might have a sense of some of the strategies involved in advancing the interests of one nation against another. So one of the most important aspects of it is military power. So your little soldiers that you put on the map. So both the threat of an actual violent coercion. This includes the presence of military bases on foreign soil, ground invasions, and so on. And without this, I think American dominance, America obviously being the most powerful world power in the world today, American dominance could not be asserted across the world in the way it has been. And America has hundreds and hundreds of military bases in countries all across the world. And it's not like that's because all of these countries just said, why don't you have a military base? That would be really nice. We'd really like to hang out with you. And you can see as well, in the last few years, China has been doing a similar thing. So they've been building artificial militarized islands in the South China Sea and embarking in really large-scale military funding to try to compete with the US. And so now they're only second behind the US. However, in the real world, imperialism is not purely about how many soldiers you have in on a country on the map. It's also about economic power and economic imperialism. And this, by this I mean the power of a country's corporations and their penetration into other economies. One of the most obvious signs of American economic dominance around the globe is, for example, the fact that the American dollar is the standard by which all other currencies are measured. People often remark, and it is true as well, the presence of McDonald's and other American companies in virtually every country in the on the globe, and the huge investment of the American state into various countries that defend their interests, most notably Israel in the Middle East, which people would know gets the most funding from America, but Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, a whole series of other countries that are seen to defend the interests of the US get massive funding as well. America also uses things like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and so on to dictate the terms of world trade in their interests. And China, again, the rising kind of power beginning to challenge some of this, is making a bid for its own network, which makes less powerful countries economically dependent on it. So they've embarked on massive investment projects across Latin America and Africa and Central Europe. And their ambitions are stated and go further than that in their attempts to construct the One Belt, One Road, if people have heard of that, which is basically an initiative that will connect the two ends of Eurasia over land and over sea in an attempt to establish China's economic control of a whole swathe of land. The other kind of form of power and the other way that these imperialist tensions are carried out is what I would refer to as soft power, by which I mean diplomacy, kind of cultural dominance, institutions like the UN and the League of Nations before it, and so on. And these are often seen as like just a nice way of keeping the peace or something, but I think they very much are a way of establishing and maintaining the dominance of certain powers, in particular the US, in the world today. They also, of course, do enable these countries to peacefully, in some cases, settle disputes about trade or borders or so on. But all of that is just the kind of nice face of what lies underneath it, which is economic and military power. And China, too, has been attempting to construct something of its own system of alliances and diplomacy, separate from the US. So people might have heard of BRICS. It's like Brazil, Russia, India, China, something. South Africa. I think it's actually something, you'll find. And recent attempts to get the EU to join with China in condemning Trump's tariffs, for example, and him pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. And the Time magazine declared last year that it did not take long for China to fill America's shoes on climate change. So there's an attempt to have a kind of, it's a nicer face of it, but it's the same thing. It's a rivalry being played out in the halls of diplomatic institutions. And you see as well that I think some of the things that play into this as well are like the bombastic pronouncements of various leaders or the really highly dramatized, televised kind of meetings that they have. Like if anyone watched the meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump and all of the kind of drama surrounding it, most of which is theatre, which obscures the underlying power dynamics between nations. And as in the game of diplomacy, if you've ever played it, it can end friendships, such alliances and the kind of, you know, that stuff is very fragile and prone to breaking. And in the end, I think military power and economic power is what really matters. And so this all makes for some quite tricky strategic decision-making on the part of the world's ruling classes, and there are often debates about what to do. Their plans for dominance can shift over time and can include things that seem relatively harmless or even positive, so like just investing in, you know, the economies of other countries. America, for example, after World War II, was like, oh, you've been bombed to shit? Oh, we'll invest in everything. We'll rebuild the whole of Europe for you, but with American companies, and you will use oil to do it, so that we can maintain our dominance over the whole of the globe. The motivation, regardless of what is stated, is always the extension of their ruling class's ability to accumulate capital at the expense of their rivals. I think things are further complicated often by the need of each ruling class to control and discipline their own workers. Occasionally, this has seen governments actually accelerate a drive to war because of the temporary kind of disciplining effect that war and nationalism can have on domestic populations. At other times, though, I think this is often more the case, war weariness of the population has had to factor into the ruling class's calculations about their imperialist strategy. So for a very long time, Vietnam War syndrome afflicted the American population, which was basically not wanting to go to war again because it had been so horrific. And this left the US state briefly incapable of launching a kind of full-on ground invasion for fear of massive backlash at home. And war really in that period, in the 80s and 90s afterwards, had to be re-established and kind of rehabilitated in popular consciousness through a series of so-called humanitarian interventions. Oh, they're just about helping poor people in Africa or the Middle East or whatever. And sometimes even the drive to war that is so inherent in capitalism can actually prove a real danger to the capitalist classes that engage in it. World War I, for example, was ended by a series of revolutions and mutinies among the belligerent nations. Desertions were rife in the armies of Europe, and masses of workers and soldiers overthrew the Tsar in Russia and the Kaiser in Germany and actually ended the war. So it is not the case that the ruling class always get their way, and it is not the case that their drive to war always ends in their favour. The resistance as well of people who are occupied, invaded, and murdered by imperialist powers has often shaped the outcomes of war and is another calculation that often factors in. Rebellions from below against Nazi occupations of southern Europe in World War II managed to kick the German army out of Italy, France, and Greece and inspire democratic and even socialist experiments in a lot of those countries. The one that people know probably more about, and there's going to be a session about it at this conference, is America's invasion of Vietnam, which was heroically defeated, really, by the Vietnamese themselves, whose struggle gave encouragement to anti-war activists all around the world, especially in America, but here in Australia as well, and it led to resistance by American soldiers. So I think while war may be a rich man's game, it actually needs to use the masses of people as its cannon fodder, masses of people who have no interest in blowing the shit out of each other, and can fight back and resist. And if the invaded people do fight back or imperialist armies crumble under rebellion, war can and has been ended. Sometimes, though, I think, despite those dangers of war for the ruling classes, it can be their only option. In order that they not be eliminated as a significant imperialist power by a rising contender, things must be decided in the last instance on the battlefield. And this was definitely the case in World War I and World War II, that despite even hesitations on the part of the ruling classes, despite the fact that they were deeply economically integrated into each other's, they had heaps of trade networks between them, Still, they could not solve their rivalries and competition anywhere other than on the battlefields of Europe, blowing themselves up. Using these kind of analytical tools that I've just set out, I think we can just briefly try to trace the shifting state of world imperialism that's brought us to where we are today. So for a time, obviously, Britain was the most powerful empire in the world, although its contenders were not far behind. And like I said, World War I and World War II were about a struggle between blocks of power against others to see who would emerge as top dog. And while Germany sought to grab the colonies it had missed out on in the initial stages of capitalist development, England and France sought to break the backs of its rivals and divide up the old Ottoman Empire. World War I kind of ended in a stalemate, and it meant that they had to go to war again in World War II, after which America emerged as the unrivaled superpower, pretty much because Europe had blown themselves to smithereens. America then set about creating its own world order that we are familiar with because we still essentially live under it. They ended the formal empires of Europe and promoted free market expansion. They basically made the whole of Europe and the whole world extremely dependent on oil, Middle Eastern oil in particular, which America controlled. They set up institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, and what eventually became the World Trade Organization as a way of asserting its economic priorities around the world. And it opened up virtually every country to world trade and eventually defeated the USSR, its only real kind of rival, militarily at least, in the Cold War. And since then, America has gone about, it's been challenged a few times. The Vietnam War period was not a very good one for America, but it has been able to maintain its hegemony on the world stage and impose neoliberalism everywhere since the 1980s. It's used finance capital and its impressive economic growth to globalise the economy and recover from some of the kind of crises of the 70s that it experienced. They did make a miscalculation more recently, though, which was the project for the New American Century, which was basically the name for the attempt to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. And the plan was to go much further than that and re-establish American hegemony over the whole Middle East. It was like, first of all, Iraq, Afghanistan, then Iran, then Lebanon, whatever, Syria, chuck them all in. That obviously failed quite desperately, and I think it's been one of the factors that has led to the rivalry we now see between the US and China. The US basically failed in its attempt to put in place a series of America-friendly regimes from Iraq to Iran. And it's led to basically the empowerment of some of the other regional powers in that area, so places like countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia even, who have been able to throw their weight around more recently in the Middle East, in places like Syria, for example, where America has not really dared to launch any kind of ground invasion to say, no, this is the kind of regime we want to see here. Iraqi oil, for example, one of the prizes, supposedly, of invading Iraq, is largely not controlled by America at all. It's controlled, a lot of it, by China, which gives you a sense of the kind of situation the US is in. The recent rise of China and the kind of relative decline of US power is basically what has got us to the situation we're in now. The US was hit very hard by the global financial crisis, which China was essentially able to ride out and continue its insane levels of economic growth. And the fact that the US has not been able to just sort of assert its military strength everywhere has led to this kind of multipolar, people are calling it, world, one that is still skewed towards America, but in which there are many economic powers with imperialist ambitions and are kind of embarking on a struggle against one another. Now, those ambitions always existed. It's just that America was so dominant for so long that the idea that you could really challenge America's hegemony was crazy. But now China very much is on that path, at least, even if America is still top dog. So this brings us to the US's strategy and Trump. Because a lot of people kind of, I think, mistakenly think that Trump represents this huge shift away from what was already occurring in the Obama years. There is a shift, definitely, which I'll explain. But it's worth saying that the pivot to Asia is the terminology of the Obama administration. It was basically an acknowledgement that China was was experiencing this rapid growth and that it was beginning to pose a real threat to US dominance. And so that kind of a sense of that strategy at least begun under Obama, as did some of the tariffs actually against China as well. So although I think to some people Trump can just seem to be lashing out in a totally erratic, crazy way, there is a logic to what he's doing. It's not like the Democrats totally disagree with everything he is doing. For example, they love that he increased the military budget. In fact, they were like, no, jack it up more. And they also do think that China is a problem and needs to be dealt with, even if they do think that the way he's going about it is not going to solve things. So while there are disagreements on the exact strategy to pursue, the dynamism of the Chinese economy and their obvious bid to be a world superpower challenging the US has put the US ruling class in a position where it has to fight now to maintain its dominance. Trump, his strategy to do this is basically lash out as much as possible and try to right what he sees as a series of, the kind of weakening of US, try to rectify that. So he's doing that on a series of levels, the levels I talked about before. On an economic level, he's attempting to wage a trade war against not just China, but basically anyone who can be perceived to be ripping off the US. He's doing it through soft power as well, ripping up all these trade deals, saying, fuck the UN and all these other organisations, they don't do what we want anymore. And importantly, he's doing it through a reassertion of US military power, so developing more nuclear weapons, increasing US military spending to its highest point ever. And all of this is basically an attempt, I think, to hold back Chinese development while reasserting American power everywhere, even in relation to its allies as well, because that can also seem crazy. Why is he hurting Europe and Canada and Mexico and Southeast Asia? But the key thing is about asserting US power and hegemony, and that power has always been exercised over lots of different countries, not just its so-called enemies. So the question then is all-out war still possible? And I think it's wrong, as some socialists and some people on the left have thought, that wars are an aberration or that it's possible for capitalism to just kind of get rid of them. They're just a kind of crazy side effect that comes out sometimes. I think wars are absolutely endemic to capitalism, as is competition. And what we're seeing now with the rise of China is a real contender against America, and America will absolutely and is lashing out against it. And I think as well some argue that globalization means that wars between major powers are unlikely today because trade and investment is so integrated between them. Like if your government goes to war with a rival power, there's a chance that your factories and offices and kind of economy might get blown up. Or sanctions will be imposed on you and, ruin your ability to trade. And all of that is absolutely true, but it has never stopped wars from happening. Every war that has ever happened has been between two major, or more than two, major economic rivals. And economic rivals and, political rivals always have very much enmeshed economies, sort of by definition. The other thing that's been argued by some, so Leo Panitch, who's a socialist in Canada, is that the US has Canadianized the world's, the other capitalist classes of the world. So essentially disempowered every other country's capitalist class from having its own autonomous interests separate from the US and forcing them to see America and its global institutions as the ultimate guarantor of global capitalist interests. And so from this, it was concluded that inter-imperialist rivalries are a thing of the past. I think, obviously, when you look at the threat that China poses, that is not the case. And I think it means that, instead, escalating tensions can trigger an actual war. And as well as that, before an actual war, it can trigger kind of proxy wars as well. And related to that idea is a very unhelpful idea on the left that I wanted to really quickly address, that you should be soft on dictatorships or the imperialism of countries other than the US. And this has become very popular. It was obviously a position held by Stalinists throughout the last 100 years because, you support the USSR against Western imperialism, of course, rather than seeing that both of them have similar imperialist interests. They're just directed at each other, so neither are supportable. And I think the kind of most common way that this is expressed today is support for the Syrian regime, a horrific dictatorship which has massacred hundreds of thousands of its own people to stop a popular revolution, and seeing everything that happened in Syria as this horrible plot of the US. I think the actual position of socialists should be that we have no truck with capitalist classes anywhere in the world, regardless of whether they call themselves anti-imperialist, and regardless of whether they their imperialism is directed against the US. Because while some may be more powerful than others on the world stage, they are all swept up in the same dynamic of capitalist competition. And all of that is horrendous for the masses of people across the world. It means war, it means occupation, and it just means maintaining the capitalist order as well, that exploits people. And so you see this in all sorts of countries. Like, they all spend massively on their military, to the detriment of people, their own population or whatever. There is no country in the world that is exempt from this dynamic. Okay, so I just wanted to really quickly talk about Australia.
And
okay, all right. Well, it's sometimes claimed by more nationalist sections of the left, including the Labor left in Australia, that Australia doesn't have imperialist ambitions to the extent that it's participated in any wars. It's just been dragged into them as a kind of lapdog of America or of Britain before that. Or that its army, you know, just serves in as self-defence, and then it's unfortunately been used, to fight other people's wars. I think nothing could be further from the truth. Rather astoundingly, despite Australia being a fairly remote island, which has literally never suffered a ground invasion since colonisation, it has one of the largest military budgets relative to population. In absolute military spending, Australia ranks 13th in the world and 11th per capita. Australian capitalists have also done quite handsomely out of its alliance with the United States. Being part of the kind of squadron of world police has allowed Australia to throw its weight around Southeast Asia, both shoring up its own business interests and ensuring that a faithful American ally is top dog in that region, and particularly with the aim of ensuring that none of America's enemies fill that role. And I think Australia needs the US as well. It's a kind of relationship that goes back and forth. It's naval bases protect the most important shipping lanes, which Australian capitalism needs to survive. And this is why loving the US is just an article of faith for the whole Australian capitalist class, whether Liberal or Labor. It's why they all just, like, fall over themselves to fawn over someone like Trump. It doesn't matter who the president is. They'll love him. And it's why the Australian ruling class has always happily sent troops to die in wars, which the US and before it Britain engage in all over the world. It's a way of reminding their powerful allies that actually protect Australian interests in this region of the usefulness of Australia. And Australia also exercises its own kind of dominance of the Southeast Asian region on that basis. The PNG Defence Force was literally created by Australia. 2,000 troops put down an anti-government protest in the Solomon Islands in 2003, because to bring down the Solomon Islands government would have meant a challenge to Australia's dominance there. And thousands of troops were sent to East Timor between 1999 and 2013, which allowed Australia to literally steal all of East Timor's oil for a period. So, the rise of China has presented new challenges for the Australian ruling class. While continuing to sort of have to court China economically, because China is Australia's number one export market by far, the government and the ruling class here have insisted on the importance of the US alliance and have begun, I think, to whip up anti-Chinese racism as well. And that's been seen most recently in the passing of the anti-espionage laws, like, oh, this, all this Chinese, you know, nefarious behaviour going on in Australia, rather than, like, there's so much American dominance of Australian parliament and politics. There's also been the promotion of Clive Hamilton's new book, The Silent Invasion, which is just a kind of, like, scare campaign about Chinese businessmen and politicians and stuff exerting all this influence in Australia. Not to say that they don't exert any influence, and they do obviously try to assert their interests here, but, like, compared to what the US is able to do, it's absolutely nothing. So I'll have to start to wind up. So I think what this means for the left is opposing our own country's nationalism and militarism. We shouldn't ever buy into any argument that increasing military spending or building tanks or whatever is about national defence or creating jobs or anything like that. It is all about gearing up for conflagration between imperialist rivals. We shouldn't think that there is some nice section of the capitalist class who don't have an interest in this, like as though it's only the people who directly benefit from oil trade or whatever that are interested in it. It has always been the case that ruling classes as a whole are pro-war when necessary. So the Labour Party here, the Democrats in America. I think we should also not be for transforming our opposition to American imperialism into support for other imperialisms or fucked up regimes around the world. We should oppose humanitarian interventions, so-called, which are, like, almost no one believes in this anymore, but it's worth just asserting that the imperialism of our government against weaker, oppressed nations is never justified in any way. I think what it's going to mean in Australia in coming years is really opposing the kind of ramping up of militarism, opposing the racist fear-mongering about China or Chinese takeovers of Australia or something being used to justify Australia being put more on the war footing with China. And I think ultimately what we are for is internationalism. The working classes of the entire world have no interest in this entire system that constantly pits countries against each other, uses racism and nationalism to justify it. And war, I think, is one of the most devastating outgrowths of capitalism and something that it cannot do without. And it should be a real rallying call that we need to get rid of the whole capitalist system in order to end it.